Blog Talk Radio.
There to all the listeners and all the listeners participating tonight in the chat room. It's good to see everybody out there. This is Movie Geeks United. How you doing, Jerry?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
It's good. It's good. It's been a nice relaxing weekend.
Yes, it has.
And we've had a great response from our Wednesday show, our Indiana Jones tribute show. We got quite a community going on that night. It was a pretty spectacular feeling show.
Yeah, I mean, we had like a lot of the most people we've ever had in the chat room.
Yeah, everybody
Without
wants to talk
doubt,
about
the
yeah,
most.
Everybody wants to talk about Indiana Jones, and we're actually going to be talking about Indiana Jones in a little while because the reviews are out for the new installment. It just premiered at Cannes this morning, and for critics, and they've already done their work and gotten their reviews out.
Yeah, and
no time at all.
And there's a touch screening around here too. I mean, a lot of local critics are chiming in about it, too.
Yeah, yeah. They've been very savvy. I think they previewed for critics, like, right before they premiered for the regular audience as they can, I think.
Yeah.
You know, it's been a pretty savvy campaign in terms of Spielberg's secrecy on it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has.
Yeah, which is all for the better of the movie,
I think so. I mean, you know, you want to be somewhat surprised when you go in there in a good way. I mean, so...
So if you have problems hearing anything, which Anthony says that he's having problems hearing the show, all we can say is continue to reboot, my friend, until it appears. It gives you a hard time sometimes.
Yeah.
If anyone else has problems hearing us, please let us know. Or if anyone can hear us, rather. That would be the best bet.
Right.
Because if you can't hear us, you can't. Just let us know in the chat room. If Material Girl and all of you guys can hear me,
yeah.
Please let us know.
Yeah, just let us know, please.
We had some problems getting on the air tonight for some reason. We got a great show for you tonight, starting out with a pre-recorded interview with Rutger Hauer that we did Wednesday during the day, you know, a few hours before our Indie celebration. It was an exciting day.
That was.
To say the least. And it's an exciting interview. We're going to follow it up with a live interview with the director of a new film called The Project. It won the Audience Award at this year's Slam Dance Film Festival, director Ryan Pietrowicz. And we're going to talk about indie reviews, and we're going to also talk about the new Oliver Stone movie. I don't know if how many of you guys out there have heard about it. It is currently shooting, based upon the life of George Bush, George W. Bush, our current president. And it's a controversial project, to say the least, and we've got some feelings about it, and it's just started shooting, as we say, and it's going to be rushed into release, possibly for September, a September release, actually.
Oh, and not even October? They're going for September?
They might be going for September, as early as September. I mean, this is a big rush job here. So, yeah, but save your thoughts.
I am going to save my thoughts, okay.
Okay, let's play you guys the interview that we conducted with Rutger Hauer. If anyone has any problems hearing this, let us know in the first minute or so, and we'll restart it. But here he is, Rutger Hauer. Really exciting interview, and then we'll share our thoughts after the segment closes. He's brought to life some of the most intriguing characters to ever grace the silver screen. He possesses a one-of-a-kind presence that can express irresistible charisma as effortlessly as icy cold menace. He is quite simply one of the most fascinating and hypnotic actors of the past 30-plus years and has been featured in some of our most groundbreaking, original, and exciting films. Films like Turkish Delight, The Hitcher, Nighthawks, Lady Hawk, Blind Fury, Batman Begins, Sin City, and of course his career-defining role in Ridley Scott's visionary epic, Blade Runner. He is Rutger Hauer, and there is no one else like him. His new autobiography titled All Those Moments, Stories of Heroes, Villains, Replicants, and Blade Runners, which has just been released in paperback, Mr. Hauer delivers his extraordinary life story with tremendously appealing candor, humor, and passion. Here you have a portrait of an artist who is constantly searching and curious, always looking deep into his characters for what is most interesting and truthful. The movie geeks are honored to welcome this remarkable artist to the show to discuss his life, his accomplishments, and those passions that continue to drive him after more than 35 years in the business, Mr. Rutger Hauer. Mr. Hauer, how are you?
Yes, hi, good. That sounds really wonderful. Thank you.
I was crazy about your book. I was just giddy reading it from cover to cover.
I'm happy to hear that. I really am. It's I wrote it for an audience, not for myself.
Right. And it was surprising right off the get-go because your parents were both actors, and unlike a lot of stories that you hear from the quote-unquote show business families, they didn't discourage you from entering the acting field, did they?
No. They were hoping that I would find a way to have a life, let's say, and that it didn't really matter to them what that was, but I didn't know what to do, so they said, try the acting school after lots of different jobs, and then I did, and then I got through it, and then I got I worked for theater for 4 years, and then I was discovered on camera, let's say.
Yeah, and your first major collaborator, I guess it would have been Paul Verhoeven.
Yeah.
And you both strike me as artists who kind of relish the chance to take risks and to see how far you can go with material. Tell me some other things that you guys have in common that made that collaboration sizzle like it did.
I think it sounds funny, but the common sense I think we also have in common, which makes you not float too much. Let's say the balloons that are also full of air, we tend to kind of hold on to the earth, both of us. And I did 5 films with him and one television series.
Right.
So we kind of got to know each other, and it was always really great to work with him.
Mm. Yeah, that's one of the all-time great collaborations, in my opinion. Jerry, you actually had a question about the period of time.
Yeah, speaking
wicked
of
sense of humor, pretty much, I think, also comes in both of us. And
yeah,
but the sense of
apparent
reality.
That's apparent on screen too.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. But speaking of one of the films you collaborated with him, Soldier of Orange, and there are also several other films that you did in the World War II genre that you seem very comfortable, very at ease, because you have a very diverse range. You play, like, all characters across the whole spectrum. And I was just curious, what is it about that genre that attracts you?
Nothing, really.
Okay.
No, people ask you what genre do you like, and I don't really have a genre that I like, and I have to be honest, I don't see a lot of films. I still work very much, and then when I'm off, I tend to not look at films for a bit, and so I kind of catch up later. I think everything is make believe, whatever genre you want to call it. The thriller, The Hitcher, I thought was is one of my favorites as well. It's not that I like the genre so much, and also Blade Runner, it wasn't my genre, but I thought the script was wonderful, and it just, these films just work out, and you never know if they do or if they will, I don't think so.
Yeah.
It feels good when you make them, but you never quite know how far they will live, how long they will live. Very Blade Runner-ish.
Right, right.
How long will I live?
but I think it was probably
years.
Nighthawks was the one that brought you to America, right? To American audience?
No, not really. I mean, the film that brought me to America was, funny enough, was was Soldier of Orange.
Mm-hmm.
And I got like a limited run in cities, and I did press for that, and that was my first, it was my second time in America, because Turkish Delight was also, that was, what was it again, it was... It was up for an Oscar nomination, and then there was like a whole thing because there was a lot of nudity in the film that they called it X-rated, and that you couldn't have a nomination for an X-rated film. It was a big thing at the time. So that was my first time. The second time was Soldier of Orange, and I got a good run and a good idea, and also that was a film that Ridley saw. Why he wanted me.
Okay.
So I mean, that film in many ways is sort of my bridge to the United States,
yeah.
or for that matter, an international career.
Right.
So I owe a lot to, you know, that moment, and to also to Paul Verhoeven,
yeah.
And to the you know, the guy, the real guy, who I was performing a war hero. He just recently died, Erik Haseloff Hoelsema, and we became the best of friends. And he died when he was 90. He just died a couple of months ago.
Oh, wow.
Anyway.
It's interesting, though, how you know, Nighthawks has kind of gained a cult status now, I find, as the years go by.
Yeah, because of terrorism, and that was sort of the first, I mean, in Europe, that we had quite a bit of terrorism in Germany mostly. And the whole thing in Munich was Santos, the guy, the character in Nighthawks was based on Santos, and Santos was also in charge of a raid of the Olympic Games in Munich.
Right.
But for the States, it was a new thing. And then, of course, you know, now, I mean, this film, I think I did this film in 80, so that's now, it's almost 30 years, and then, look where we are now. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Strange.
Yeah, it is. It is. But you talk about Nighthawks not being a pleasant shoot, and then a complete 180 seemed to be Blade Runner, because for the exact opposite reason. I think you were given free rein pretty much on your character in Blade Runner while the Nighthawks experience was very constrictive.
Well, yeah, I mean, basically not so much free rein, but Ridley was open to ideas, and if he felt they made some sense, then he would use them, and that's sort of where we found each other. I mean, you know, I don't want to be left alone. I would do very strange things. I know the director, but Ridley and I found each other on that film, and that was you know, after. You know, the Nighthawks film was a hard one, and that was such a relief, because I sort of was a bit dented in terms of my beliefs of American cinema making,
right.
And filmmaking. I went, wow, if it's that way, do I want to be here? I don't think so.
Mm.
So, you know, big relief, and so nice that the film holds its own for so long. It's so amazing.
Yeah, and part of the big joy for me in reading your book was that it's clear that you're an actor with so many ideas when you come to the set, and when you explain
yeah.
those ideas and how they came to fruition, that just made me so joyful to read that in the book.
Well, thank you. That's yeah. You know, if it wasn't for the internet, I wouldn't really trust myself to write all that down, and even that is still. Let's say a map of the ideas that I have. I can't write it all down, but some of it. But the internet has given me some trust and some faith that people understand what you do, and that's very nice. I never thought they would understand that unspoken language, and they seem to really get it well. So that's
yeah.
very nice. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah. And
I'm wondering.
Nice that, yeah.
I'm wondering when you craft a performance. How much of it is, do you rely on intellect, and how much on instinct?
I think, I don't know, it's a mix. It's really hard to judge from me. I follow, you know, the director and my instinct. I follow those lines. And then if the director is in it with me, then I can start, you know, doing little fantasies and having little outings with ideas, depending on, you know, what the parameters are. But most of it comes from just, you know, imagination. I think that's where the audience needs to go, so why would I not start there?
Yeah, and so much of it happens in the moment, too. And so it has such a quality that it's just alive on screen, I find, too.
Lovely. I try, you know, and I, you know, how much certainty do you have as an actor? I don't believe you have a lot of that anyway. And I there are times that I think I'm taking a role and I think I can't do it. And that doesn't last very long because I get my senses back. But at the same time, you know, I don't know. I don't have that certainty. I don't want to go the road that I went. So I try to rediscover, you know, characters if I feel that they are repetitive. I mean, if I play a bad guy, I have to have a good sense that I can do something with it,
yeah,
you know, that is worth doing.
Blade Runner is a movie that has survived and thrived so well over the years. Do you have a preference as to which one you prefer?
A preference for what? For which draft of Blade Runner, you mean?
For which kind of Blade Runner that we think works the best?
The last one.
Really?
The last one is the one he wanted out first, and he was so right, and it's, you know, the differences are still not major, I don't think. The film always plays it because it's so strong, but this one is really a final cut, and it, you know, and you feel it. It moves better, it's warmer, it's got a little more... It got a little more heart for all the characters, you know, especially for Harrison Ford's character, who, you know, I never cared for him that much. And then I was honestly outside of my role. Like, I didn't see it happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's, you know, it's a masterpiece, you know, and it's, you know, I know no qualms saying that. And it's because of everybody, and especially Ridley's mind. But let me say something before we, you know, I would have never written the book, let's say, you know, if I wouldn't have done it for charity. I thought it would be an interesting idea to write a nice book from the center of making movies, you know, and where I stand as I do them, and see if I can raise some funding for a charity for AIDS that I have since 2000, and I do small things for that. And it's really odd because in the publicity that I do for the book, I always tell people, and it never seems to survive for some reason. And I think if, you know, if people buy a book and they know it's that all the, you know, all the profits go to HIV and some, you know, a charity that I run and that I believe in.
Starfish.
It makes a difference, I would think, you know.
Yeah. Well, I actually, in
so
my list of questions,
I just want to get that out of the way.
No, absolutely, and I think that's crucial because in my list of questions here, I wanted to focus on your organization. It's called Starfish, correct?
It's called the Starfish, the Rutger Hauer Starfish Association.
Okay. and all the proceeds from the book go to that organization, and actually. On the screen that our listeners are on right now, there's a clickable link. Click on the cover of your book. It will take them to Amazon where they can purchase it, and all the proceeds go to your foundation. So
yes,
I think that's crucial.
You know, I fought for that because, you know, I wanted to have that on there. And they said, well, you know, they'll find it inside the book. And I said, well, can you not put it on the outside of the book? You know, all that stuff. Anyway,
yeah,
you only do this once.
Right.
So tell me what your foundation, what this funding goes towards.
Well, you know, I've decided after a couple of years of struggling and trying to be a hero in some, you know, godforsaken small island where AIDS is just, you know, incredibly present, let's say, in the Turks and Caicos Islands, I decided that there would be more result if I would be a little closer to the source. And because I was, you know, I was mostly not there, so I decided to bring it to wherever I would be, I'll do something. And on that route, I've discovered some really interesting people that I can trust and that I can work with and do something good if I have, you know, if I have funding. And the other thing that I thought was, why don't I bring it back home to my own profession and see if I can find some filmmakers who will, you know, work with me on this. It doesn't, you know, just the idea, you know, a concert for AIDS. Why don't filmmakers do film for AIDS? And so that's, I'm sort of doing that at the moment. And I started it last year. So I'm bringing it home to my own craft. So, you know, I'm closer to it. And you know, we use our craft to get it out there. It's basically all about the same thing, awareness and, you know, let's not forget, you know.
Absolutely.
And then
the core
of the whole thing is that, you know, pregnant women and children, I'm trying to give them help. It doesn't matter what it is, and it doesn't matter where it is. I'll do it if I can. I think I'm going to go to Romania next. And I was there a couple of years ago, twice. And one of the things I found was that there was a village, basically, sort of almost like a concentration camp, but a nicer setup for the kids because they were orphans. Nobody cared for them, and because they did get medicine, they had to live somewhere. It was an Italian, Mino D'Amato was his name. He sort of was responsible for a whole village being built by Italians in Bucharest and Romania. Nobody stopped him because the politics couldn't stop him because they thought that was too painful, so they let him go. So illegally, he put a hospital in Bucharest, and then he put like a village for kids with HIV there, orphans. And now I'm going there. I'm going to try and get a pool together because I remember, you know, how much they wanted to go for a swim, and the river is polluted, and the swimming pools don't allow them to swim because they think that's going to kill people. So that sort of thing is what I'm doing. And I do other things, you know. I'm hoping to get some documentaries going, you know, from filmmakers who I can send to China or whatever.
Well, I applaud
Made
you.
In China. Definitely. Made in China, different brand. Yeah.
Excuse me, Mr. Howard, do you feel that you're also like battling a lot of ignorance about the AIDS?
Yeah, no, sure.
It sounds like from what you said about Romania, it sounds like there's still a lot of ignorance about the truth about the disease.
Well, yeah, I don't know what to call it. You know, it just needs to be done. It needs to be done. And there's so much, you know, that you can do, even in the little things, you know, and that's all I'm doing. I'm doing things when I can, and I know where to find them, too.
Right.
I don't look at a city, you know, through you know, the glasses of bling. You know, I take one look at a city, and I can see where the different routes are, and I'm going to go shopping. And I don't mean that in a nasty way.
Right. No,
I'm going to go shop. You know, get to know the places a bit. So
yeah.
I'm not just an actor who lives in a hotel and shoots a movie there.
Right.
Well, we have a link on our website here where they can purchase your book. And it's a fantastic, fun read, and icing on the cake that the proceeds go to help your AIDS. So I think that's absolutely essential.
Okay.
Before you go, can I ask you about The Hitcher? Because that's one of my favorite films.
You can? How long do we have?
We have as long as you want to give us, but I don't
know. All right,
I don't...
Okay. Okay, fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't want to overstep my boundaries because this is long distance, I know, but...
Never mind. Yeah, you'll live, I'm sure.
The Hitcher is absolutely one of my favorite films of that genre, just because it's so down and dirty and kind of relentless. Mm. But I had a different kind of view of how you portrayed the character from when I read your book and read your take on it. I thought that you probably it was a role that didn't require you to find the humanity in it. But you had a very...
You're right.
Is that correct, or do you have a different take on that character?
Are you asking me if it was a role that can you be a little more precise, and I'll answer it precise?
Well, because a lot of times characters, when they play so-called villains, they search to find the humanity in the character, and I thought that this was a different kind of role.
Okay. In what way?
Well, an unstoppable force.
Are you saying you didn't feel the humanity?
I thought that the character represented an unstoppable force, and that's what he was.
Right.
The
force of what? I'm interviewing you now.
Yeah.
The force of what?
Like an unstoppable, like a Terminator almost, just an unstoppable killing machine.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm not going to take that away from you. It sounds fine. I play every character as humane as I can come up with, And it doesn't matter, you know, what the character is. I play characters, I play people, basically.
Yeah.
And some people are really mean and others are not, you know. So I thought he was charming. I thought he was one of the most charming men I would meet on the road.
Okay, all right. Speaking of charming, can I ask you a question? I know I'd like to ask a question if you have the time.
Yeah, you're asking the questions.
Yes, I know. I just don't. We don't want to, keep you or anything. But speaking of monsters, or you see the good, not the good, but you take the human element of each of your characters. What was it like playing Albert Speer in Inside the Third Reich? How did you approach that material?
Well, I approached it pretty much from, you know, he'd written a book, a 500-page book in prison while he was in prison for 25
right.
years. And I sort of took the stance, and I don't think it, as an actor, I don't think you should, you know, you just have to make it believable, whatever the role is. But I thought, if the guy's in prison for 25 years, why would he lie?
Exactly.
So I based my let's say, sincerity or whatever you want to call it, on that. But then, of course, you know, 10 years later, they discover he really lied a lot in that book. So
yeah.
So he fooled me, and there you go. But, you know, so you take the ingredients that you think make sense
mm-hmm.
for the moment, and you work with them and see if the director likes them, and then you take it from there. I'm afraid it's not a life-altering experience for me most of the time.
But
you know how actors sort of tend to go, oh, yes, it changed my life. but that doesn't really seem to work for me, but maybe I'm missing something.
Well, but at the same time in your book, I mean, you're essentially reviewing your career, so you have to
moments.
Have some... Yeah, well, that's what I want to ask you about. The moments... What moments are you proudest of as an actor? Particular moments in a film where you say, "Oh yeah, that was gold for me."
Well, you know, that's sort of there are moments in some of my other films, like Legend of the Holy Drinker, I think is pretty brilliant. There's a film, the short film I did called The Room, that I think there's in the acting, but then also there's in the swordplay. I just love swordplay, you know, in Lady Hawk and in Blind Fury and in a horse riding. You know, I love all that stuff. If I see an actor who rides a horse or plays with the sword as if he is really there, you know, I just like that. And I was the master of that for a while. Let's put it that way. And that sort of simple stuff that is physical almost. It's physical. Understanding. I really like that, and I'm, you know, am I proud of Lady Hawk? Yes, I am proud, but the most proud of, I am of the battle in the end, because I did all of it, and the same goes for Blind Fury. And I don't think there's any actor who will ever do that, and I can act a little bit here and there too, you know. It's a good mix.
Well, for a while there, you know, because they talk about actors being emotional athletes, and you also used your physical athleticism as well for a good stretch of your career. That had to be fulfilling to have an opportunity to mix those two disciplines, I would think.
It is. If it works, it's great. You know, I mean, it's hard to explain it. If you get hired for a role, you shoot the movie. This is about Blind Fury. You shoot it in, where did we shot it? I mean, in Texas and in Nevada. And they finish, they edit the movie, and then they come back and go, can you come back and do a sword fight? Because, you know, the end of the film stinks, and we'd like to shoot that. And then you're in front of one of the best swordsmen in history for films, who's always had like a black cap on his face and never been seen on film. His name escapes me right now. And he says, "You can do this. You can do this." It's so wonderful. It's just so wonderful to work with these kind of people.
Yeah.
And the same goes for Horseman, and a lot of other people as well.
Yeah. I don't want to take any more of your time up. You've been so generous to us.
Yeah.
And when you come back to the States, Mr. Howard, please
Yeah.
Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you again. You're one of our favorites.
Okay. I'm going to go to Cannes first tomorrow to see if I can kind of get some wind going on a project that I want to direct for. It's been on my mind for 2 years now.
Is this a feature project?
Yeah, yeah. There's another thing that I can urge you to take a look, which is I am very proud of it because I've been working on it for 4 years now. It's an website. It's an online website for short films. I've got a great bunch of judges there, and it's for filmmakers around the world. We're asking them for their short films, and that's going to be the first festival in Milan in September.
September,
and it's
yes.
worldwide. If the films are not in English, they have to subtitle them. That's what's unusual about it. And because I did that, the quality is so high that I can, you know, already I see great power in it, basically. And lots of fun, of course. And, you know, and filmmakers, you know, the new faces, we can see them there. The new faces of film.
Yeah.
Very.
And that website is rutgerhauer.org, correct?
No, but that's my own website. This is called IC Films with IC, icfilms.org.
Okay.
You can find it inside my website, too. There's links there, but icfilms.org, and it's great fun. And, yeah, we got about 2,000 short films, and we've chosen about 120 now to run in September.
This seems like a really kind of fulfilling time in your life, because you're making your own stand and making your own difference towards AIDS. You teach acting. You have a short film competition.
They're all kind of things that give back pretty much. You know, I think I have a system down where they all come back to the same thing. I mean, on the acting part, I think I've got a Rutger Hauer Film Factory going every year, which is the same thing. We make 30 filmmakers sweat like dogs and make them shoot tons of movies. And the experience is life-altering for them, because I have something that nobody else knows. And I know where it lives, and I can bring it to them. And they love it, and it's great, you know. So that's one thing. Then it's the short films. I'm trying to get a circle going that is a real network, not a fake one. Mm-hmm. In Europe, pretty much.
Well, Mr. Hauer, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We admire your work so much, and please come back to us anytime in the future you'd like to.
Will do. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Hauer.
Okay.
Bye-bye now.
Bye. Was nice talking to you.
You too,
bye-bye,
sir. Thank you so much.
Bye. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right. That's Rutger Hauer. Jerry, what are your thoughts on the replay? Because it was one thing doing it live, and then hearing it replayed, it felt differently, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It did. What did you want me to check over at RutgerHauer.org, by the way?
ICfilms.com, if that's I in the letter C, or if it's I-S-E-E.
Let me
double check.
I think it's I-S-E-C. It is the letter I, the letter C, films.org.
Okay, there you go. That's a short film competition. It's an interesting story because, personally, I felt a dislocation when we conducted the interview because it was in Amsterdam, and I felt like we were getting some feedback, and that always feels kind of dislocating. But hearing it back, it doesn't feel like that.
No, it felt very good.
Secondly, that little... I really sort of got a little heated in the chat room.
Yeah, I mean... You know,
This is my take on it. I always thought that his role in The Hitcher was an unstoppable force, just like you said, just like a killing machine, a Terminator.
Yeah.
The point of my question was, when he describes the role in his book, and it's an exceptional book, please go out and get it. It's funny, and it has great anecdotes in it. He talks about how that character was suicidal, and he wanted to die. He wanted the C. Thomas Howell character to kill him. And the whole movie was the process of making C. Thomas Howell man up, in a way, to get him to that point where he's able to do that and reach that catharsis.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is making me look at the movie a little bit differently, because it's not as simple as like a Terminator. In his eyes, it wasn't.
Right.
So I thought it was an interesting question that kind of got derailed a little bit. But it's definitely a highlight of that interview. So,
it is.
We're so pleased to have him on. That was a big joy, wasn't it?
It was. It was a very big joy.
Yeah, it's a good time. I think our next guest is on the line. He's been patiently holding for us.
Okay.
So why don't we get started?
Let's do it.
The Project is a bold new film from writer-director Ryan Piotrowicz that follows the film received raves from the likes of Filmlot, who said it takes the faux documentary to a whole new level. The film features a great cast, including Michael Stahl David of Cloverfield fame, as it tells the story of a group of first-time filmmakers as they embark on a project that chronicles the perils of inner-city life. This astounding first-time feature from Piotrowicz, which won the coveted Audience Award at this year's Slamdance Film Festival, is gritty, intense, and beautifully executed. It is our pleasure to welcome Ryan Piotrowicz to our program, and I hope this is Ryan on the phone. Let me bring him up real quick. Ryan, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Thank you so much for joining us, man. I'm sorry you had to wait on hold for so long.
Oh, no, not a problem at all. It was a pleasure. I, you know, listening to the tail end of the interview and stuff was very interesting.
Well, thank you. Now, am I getting your last name right, Piotrowicz?
You're the closest of anyone I've ever heard that hasn't
okay.
briefed before. It's Piotrowicz, but it usually gets butchered quite a bit. So when I was at Slamdance, they would the programmer didn't know how to pronounce my last name, so she just called me her BFF. That's how I was introduced on my Q&A, so it's okay.
Oh, well. I'm usually so bad at that, so thank God I got close. But you went to Emerson's College, just like our guest last week, didn't you, Daniel Schechter? You guys attended together?
Yeah, it was actually interesting. Dan and I, we met when we were in college. He was a freshman, I was a sophomore, and we worked on this student film, someone else's film. It was called Strange Lady Musician, and it was like this somewhat student film. It was his first time. He was an AD, and I was the second AD. And then we became friends ever since, and and from then we've just worked on basically every project we've done together since then.
Yeah, it seems like a great. Just hearing the story of you guys and the collaborators that you guys share a lot of time with, it seems like a great program. Just in terms of making those connections.
Yeah, the Emerson program. See, the way I look at when I went to school when I first started out with filmmaking, I didn't have none of my friends from home really were into it and stuff, and I had been doing stuff when I was younger, but at Emerson they really give you the opportunity, if you are proactive enough, to go out there and join the extracurricular programs where they have this opportunity to meet these kids that are just as passionate about making films as you are, and they'll work on your projects for free and you'll work on theirs, and it's just a very strong community when it comes to that proactivity of getting involved. Maybe not necessarily the classes, they'll teach you the basics, but the extra stuff is where we found our, kind of niche over at Emerson.
Yeah. So what were some early inspirations for you in terms of films and filmmakers that inspired you originally?
My first film film that I always say that my favorite film of all time is The Neverending Story. It's probably because when I was growing up, I watched this every day. My father, I had it up. There was the first movie I ever saw in the theater, and I came back, and I remember when VHS came out, and I burnt out three VHS tapes of it by watching it so much. And I watch it now, and a lot of the same themes, the sort of way I live my life and a lot of that stuff, it's sort of what became my mantra as to how to live, like follow your dreams and things of that nature. And for some reason, that film is just, to me, that was the reason I wanted to make movies, and that's always been sort of my drive since really loving that film and wanting to know how it was done, and from then on, I've just wanted to make movies.
Well, that's fantastic. That's an answer we don't hear very often.
Yeah, that's a very popular film with my generation, The Neverending Story. Very popular.
Yeah. So this is your first feature film. Tell me how the idea of it came to be. What inspired it?
The inspiration for this film, I grew up in Boston and stuff, and I grew up in a very liberal family, and my, always was taught to be accepting of others and things of that nature, and just, always had that sort of eclectic mix of people around me my whole life, and, I went to college and in Boston, and Boston's sort of it's a very demographic of the city. I mean, my film, to give whoever's listening to, give them a little heads up, my film deals with issues of race in class, and that's sort of one of the impetuses for me to explore that was the reason I kind of wanted to go in to do this project. So what happened was, I moved to Brooklyn, and I just saw such a different diversity of life than I did growing up in Boston, and I really wanted to explore that, and as myself, I wanted to go up there and meet people and talk to people and try to figure out what is, you know, why are there class separations, racial separations, and just think about it. And before I knew it, I was sort of immersed in this subject matter that I was trying to think about, watch, and talk to, and, you know, I was being threatened because I was overstepping my boundaries.
Yeah.
So, and I had a gun put in my face in a, you know, I was doing some research and in some inner city projects and stuff, and I was mugged. And then I realized, obviously, I'd overstepped my boundaries. I was where I shouldn't have been. But that was the reason where I said, took a step back and said, I wanted to explore it from all the angles of the filmmaker doing his research and, you know, pushing his limits and things like that. So I really just took a step back and took a view of my own life and sort of what was going on and put it in this little bubble and made it into a movie.
Yeah, and it follows the story of a couple of NYPD officers and also an inner city youth. I mean that's the focus of your film in terms of the main characters it follows, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So the NYPD officers. It's like the premise is the boyfriend girlfriend couple moved to Brooklyn to make a film about inner city life, and they have someone filming them as they go through the process. And before you know it, they sort of, their worlds collide, they lose their objectivity, and they're very actively participating in the world. They were just looking to document. And
right.
I think that was pretty much what happened with that, the ideas. And the stuff with the police officers really never came, was something I wanted to even do. I was like, oh, okay, I'll throw those characters in just to flesh the story out and give it three parts. And then I really, when I started researching that stuff, I really grew attached to the whole concept of, like, what is the system in New York? What is the difference between these two and why are they clashing and stuff? Before, it was just a vehicle for exposition when I was doing my first draft. And then
right.
I became extremely attached to those characters and what I was doing and really developed them around in the third draft.
Well, that's kind of what I'm interested in, because it's a powder keg of a concept. I mean, it's controversial and touchy as you can get when you start to explore race relations a lot of times. So I'm wondering, when you do your pre-production work and you say you met with this hostility, and what kinds of questions were you asking? What were you wanting to explore?
I was, I'm not sitting. The thing about me is I'm not really a social worker. You know, this person who's like, I own loose cannon at times as well, where I would
right.
go out, and I wouldn't be doing this and, like, going to schools and saying, let me talk to your kids. Like, I'd be going out, being, you know, two sheets to the wind drunk, 4 a.m, walking through projects and like, hey, what's going on? You know, I buy some weed. Whatever. Try to talk to dudes and then try to, hey, what's it like? I just want to know about race. How do you feel being black in America? How do you feel living in these projects? Inappropriate questions, maybe. And leads to, you know, something else happening from. That's sort of what was kind of going on, and it wasn't really a focused, guided, calculated plan. Like, it was like,
right.
I just had this bug in my stomach. Like, I want to go out there and make this movie and just immerse myself in this thing, and it just sort of, that came about. It wasn't a calculated, like, I'm going to go out there now. It was like, I would just have a couple of drinks and be like, I'm going to go to the projects right now. Like, that's where that came from. And how do the cops deal with you, things like that. And then a lot of people were very, like, good and cool about it. And then some people, you need to shut your mouth, get out of here. Are you a cop? Things like, I got that question a lot. So, yeah.
Well, tell me about the – I think it's fascinating, this faux documentary style as it's been described. Was that part of the concept from the beginning? And what's tough about executing something like that?
The concept of the faux documentary in the beginning was that really wasn't the concept. What it was I wanted to make a movie about this gang of kids in New York. Like, I love movies like The Warriors, and I know that's, like, over the top and stuff, but I really also related to films like, say, Boys in the Hood, where I would just, those films that really got to me, and just even a film like, say, Requiem for a Dream, even though it's not about gangs or anything, it's about kids going through hardship in the city and going through personal struggle, and that's what originally it was. It was just a focus on that. It was another movie about growing up, you know, in the tough streets of New York or something.
Yeah.
And as I started to research, and what I call research of what I was doing, I realized that I was being so pushy and aggressive and just not really, I was crossing boundaries, which I shouldn't have been as a filmmaker, and that's where I wanted to that's where I decided to take it out and make it into the faux documentary. And the reason that it facilitated a lower budget as well, because then I could utilize DV cameras, I could utilize, you know, all the different technologies that we have when it comes to new cameras and things of that nature, also editing and just keeping it on the cheap, being able to shoot a lot of footage. And then I used that as part of my business plan pitch to get my first feature made, and that was one of the other reasons why it was done. It was sort of out of necessity to get the money to make this movie.
Well, how much of it is scripted and how much of it is open to kind of the surprise element?
It's about over 90% scripted. I mean, there are scenes that are improvised, certain actors improvise scenes within themselves, but for the most part, it was written with a three-act structure. You know, I tried to hit my beats at when I was supposed to and, you know, really tried to execute it in that way. And every character had an arc, and I did all the, you know, I wrote it all out on a big graph and a big board, chalkboard in my, you know, my room and stuff, and every had their moments and their hits and stuff like that. And when I wrote it, the dialogue and stuff is pretty much there, like all the kids' dialogue is stuff I wrote. And then some of the interviews were improvised, and that was where most of the, like Matt Servito, he would do a lot of great improv, and Michael and the kids, when they would do their interviews, the impromptu interviews, but that was about it.
So tell me about the shoot. Was it a true guerrilla style shoot? How long did you have?
It was not a true guerrilla style shoot. It was Renart Films, who produced Goodbye Baby as well, you know, and producer Tim Duff. Like we really structured it with, you know, we had a crew that was paid full. We had a full art department, a full sound department. We had trucks. You know, we did it right. We got our permits. Everything was totally. Locations manager, all actors, costume, wardrobe, I mean costume, makeup, everybody was there, big crew, and we shot it in 17 days. And it was the work of, say, like Daniel Sharnoff and the actors that make it have that gritty feel, but it was very calculated.
Well, it really does paint a picture of New York, too. I mean, you really feel New York in the film. That had to be a stunning experience to shoot within the city and the places that you did shoot.
Yeah, it was great because I have been here for a while, and about 2 years now, and I worked on Dan's movie Goodbye Baby as a locations manager, and that experience was the first experience I had. Like, I had never been in locations department, and when I did that, I got to explore the city to no end, and I was just going all over the place, had so many pictures, and I just saw all these cool places, and some of them we could use for Goodbye Baby and some of them we couldn't. And when it came time to do the project, I had a list of a ton of locations, like, okay, let's go here, 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 and shoot all these things that I wanted to do with Goodbye Baby. And then we were able to just utilize them again, and then we had, you know, pick up a couple extras here and there. But being able to shoot in New York with the crew that I had was a fantastic experience, yes.
Yeah, I bet. And for our movie geeks out in the audience, and I know we have a lot of them are movie geeks, but what did you shoot on? You shot DV, but what was the model camera?
Yeah, what kind of camera?
We did the SDX 900, which is what it's a Panasonic camera. It's what they shoot Laguna Beach on. And because the thing about, like, I don't watch shows like Laguna Beach or The Hills, but I have seen them, and I always kind of follow how the phenomenon of why those shows are so popular. And when that first came out, I go, that just looks different. It doesn't look like film, obviously. It doesn't look like video. It's got this sort of 24p bubbly vibe to it. I don't know how to describe it, and I really wanted to do that. So we got an HD zoom lens, and we got this nice camera, and then we shot it on that. And I didn't want to do HD because I don't want it to be too clean.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
It really does. It really has changed movie making, especially for the independent filmmaker. I mean, the portability and the image quality, it's really stunning, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's so great to have that access to be, you know, to get your creative ideas up there, to get your vision out there. And don't get me wrong, if I were to shoot a movie, you know, with a big budget, I would love to get, you know, dollies and jibs and cranes and, you know, I would love to do it. Like, I want to do my next film. I definitely want to have it in the regular structure, opposed to having this handheld, but I did that. That was almost like a tool in which I needed to utilize to tell my story, and also to get the right amount of money so I could do my first film.
I'm interested in what kind of reaction your film has gotten. I mean, I know you were a hit at Slam Dance. What kind of reaction have you gotten from viewers of the film?
I couldn't have asked for a better reaction, because what it is some people really enjoy it and like it, and they get it, it raises good provocative questions to them, or they want to have a discussion, or they understand it on their own level. Some people absolutely hate me for making it and hate the film. I've been reamed after a couple of Q&As for making the movie and saying that I didn't answer any questions about race and stuff and what am I doing to promote peace and things of that nature. And I really enjoy those questions, because I'm not trying to say that's what I'm doing. I made a movie that would raise those questions for others and provoke discussion about race, opposed to just letting it sit there in the corner and say, oh, yeah, but after the film, maybe people will talk, and some people will hate it, and some people will love it, and that conversation that will happen is why I made this movie.
Yeah.
So that people will talk.
And I find that when a movie has such polarizing, like opposing viewpoints attached to it, you really have something there. I mean, you have a movie
I agree.
That live.
I think that's very true.
So how can our audience find it? Is it still playing festivals?
It is playing. We are doing one more festival, and then we're looking to do right now we're doing one in Seattle, which isn't the Seattle Film Festival. We're doing the Seattle Truly Independent Film Festival. Same time, it's like the Slam Dance of the Seattle Festival. But that we're excited. We're a premiere thing on a Saturday night. We're big screening there. So that's on like June 13th, and that's the one time that I know that it's playing for sure. We are in talks with distribution. I'll tell you that through my goal is for the fall. We're looking for a fall release, and I want to do a grassroots marketing campaign and really get it out there. And we're talking to some distributors now, and hopefully things will work out in our favor when it comes to that stuff.
Well, please keep us posted on that, man, because I mean this is a great film and it needs to be seen. So anything that we can do. When you have the distribution deal down, please come on the show again and share it with us, okay?
I will.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ryan. That's Ryan Pietrowicz. See, I think I pronounced it right that time. There you go.
You're getting better. I mean, you're doing better than anyone else.
His fantastic new film is called The Project, and it's playing at festivals. Hopefully a distribution deal at the fall, like you just said. Be on the lookout for it. It's a very worthwhile film.
Mm-hmm.
And now we turn to Chris. We have Chris on the line. Hey, buddy.
Hey, what's up, guys?
Hey, how are you?
Yo.
chilling like Bob Dylan on penicillin here.
Damn, we get poetry, too. Fuck yeah.
Yeah, Chris is a poet. You didn't know that.
No, I did not know that.
We've got a couple of things to talk about, man. I don't know if you've been searching the net today, but the big news today is indie premiere at Cannes. Have you been looking at any of the reviews?
Yes, I saw a couple of those reviews. They all came at once. It was like a big money kind of Indiana Jones reviews just splooged all over the internet at once. Some pretty interesting ones. Basically, kind of what I expected anyway, I think.
In a good or a bad way?
No, I mean in a good way. You know, I mean, mostly positive from what I've read. You know, there have been a couple of people that, even the people that, or you know, had negative things to say about it, didn't say it was awful. So
no one said it's disappointing. That's the interesting. They say the middle sort of. It seems the consensus is the middle sort of drags.
Yeah.
But the beginning and ending, especially the beginning, is incredible.
Yeah.
I know Michael Phillips gave it a fairly negative review, but he is one of those critics that's very hard to please. He doesn't hate everything, but he's kind of hard to please. So,
Hollywood Reporter, I think, gave it a unfavorable review.
But Variety loved it.
Variety loved it. LA Times was probably the most beaming of the reviews I read. Entertainment Weekly was very positive about it. But you're right. They tend to say that they say it opens up, you know, how much action can you fill in the first 22 minutes of a movie? They say that that's what the first 22 minutes feel like in this movie. It's like action packed, which reminds me of Temple of Doom.
Mm-hmm. We were watching that today.
And it fits to reason too that they would all say that the middle kind of lags a little bit, because that when you open a movie with such a bang like that. And then you've got to go into your exposition, and you have to introduce all these new characters as well. I mean, there's several new characters in this piece.
Right.
You know, it stands to reason that would happen. somewhat. But then they say they redeemed themselves beautifully at the last act with more just astounding action. And there's actually a review I read that say that this car chase is as good as anything in any indie movie. It
Even the first
the
one?
It rivals the Jeep chase in Raiders, and if any piece of this movie will be studied decades from now, it will be that car chase.
Wow.
Yeah.
Maybe, that's cool. That is really exciting, actually. But I think maybe I'm alone, but the action from the Indiana Jones movies, it's never been top-notch action. They haven't been, like, thrill rides all the way through. For me, that's not the best thing about Indiana Jones. The best thing about Indiana Jones is him and, you know, his rapport with his leading lady, whichever one it is, all three of them, you know, he had a funny relationship
mm-hmm.
with. It's like the comedy and the fact that it's a family film that's so entertaining.
It's almost Howard Hawks kind of, you know.
Yeah, very, very clean. You know, the action, even when it's at its best, it probably wouldn't make, you know, the top 50 action sequences of all time, you know. It's just not that kind of action.
See, I love the action, but I do love the action sequences, but I think they ride on what you're talking about, which is the fact that you so empathize with Indy.
And they have heart and soul. The films have a heart and they have
yeah.
a soul.
Yeah. I think that's why the action works better than in some mechanical movie.
But I do love that truck chase in the first one.
Oh,
the,
yeah.
The first time I saw that was incredible.
And the chase through the tunnels at the end of 2, you can't
mm-hmm.
really deny that.
Right, absolutely.
The boat chase in the third one is a pretty good action sequence, too.
I like the tank sequence in the third one, too.
Yeah, that's great. It's
another
great.
Sequence. Yes.
Now, if there has to be something that is dividing critics, which I guess it's all a matter of personal taste, they seem to be very divided on the heart aspect. I find that a quarter of them are saying, you know, it has no heart. It's a CGI stunt spectacular. And the other half are saying, you know, it has the same charm as the old ones. It's an Indiana Jones movie.
Right.
So it's very unique to see such disparaging takes on the movie. You know, some people find it has heart and some don't. So
let me just say this, and we'll know by a week from now. But I think if you just go in and you have fun with this film, you get some nostalgia and other things, what more can you ask for?
Yeah, yeah.
We're not
I'm asking for another Indiana Jones. I think
that
all of us are asking for.
I'm not asking for like to them. I don't want them to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, there's actually a scene in the movie where they reinvent the wheel. By the way, it's interesting.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Jamie. Thanks, sir.
There's been a lot of naysayers. Now I know I said I had a bad feeling about the movie, but that was just a general bad feeling. I don't have any expectations.
You're like Han Solo. You have a bad feeling.
Yeah, I just have a very generalized bad feeling. But there have been a lot of people talking, you know, about specific points of this movie that they think are bad. Like it's got a lot of CGI, or it's got a sci-fi aspect, or it looks too silly. You know, there's been a lot of people saying that. But if you go back and watch the movies, they've always been silly. They, you
mm-hmm.
know, I mean, like. All of the humor in the movie is pretty much based around Indiana Jones being an ass or making an ass of himself in
right.
one way or another. And he's always had a sidekick. You know, I've heard some flack about Shia LaBeouf, and there's been a sidekick in every movie.
There has been.
There's a supernatural undertone to all the MacGuffins in the three as well.
Yeah, and this one, I think...
It's always been there.
Yeah,
so.
And this one, I think people are getting a little bit... upset because it has a sci-fi element towards the end of it. So what?
A box that you open up that melts faces off. That seems a little supernatural to me.
Yeah, I don't... I think people are nitpicking, just want to find reasons to hate it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think
And it's just enough already.
That being said, next Sunday we will get you will get all of our reviews of the film. We're going to share our uncensored thoughts.
Oh,
so,
you didn't hear. I'm flying up to New York to see Postal. I won't be seeing... All right, no, I'm lying. But but speaking of Postal, because I thought that show was great with Dr. Boll, our good friends at Horror Movie Fans have on Uwe Boll tonight at 10 o'clock. So be sure to
Let
listen
Let me tell
to
you
that.
Guys at Horror Movie Fans, you guys have a fantastic show. Get ready for Killerwood tonight.
I always want to call in and have a drink because it sounds like they're having a party on there.
He is going to be loaded for bear, man. I have been in touch with Uwe Boll. I say this. I've been sending him emails back and forth about four or five times this weekend. because he sent me that letter, that form letter that he sends out to the media about how no one's running postal. So I said, you know, who's behind it? I mean, who's the puppet master?
And he sent you the email.
So many exhibitors out there, and he sent me an email, and he gave me the list of exhibitors for the three major theater chains and their email addresses. I thought, man, wouldn't it be fun to get those guys on with Uwe Boll?
Dude, that would be one of the greatest shows ever.
That would be our throwdown episode. Yeah, go ahead, Ben.
Yeah.
I thought Chris was about to say something.
Yeah, I thought Chris was going to.
No, I wasn't talking at all.
Oh, okay.
But it is something else. I mean, he was planning on an 1800 screen release. I don't know if that was a given or not. I
was under that impression until you posted that thing on last week. I was under that impression.
You know, there are some. I don't know that his movie reflects it. I don't. But if you hear his words out of a respected director's mouth. When you talk about, you know, I'm not just saying that Bush was wrong about WMDs. I'm saying that he belongs in jail for doing that. If you heard, like, Oliver Stone say that, which this is a great segue, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think you'd take it a lot more, you'd certainly take it a lot more seriously. But the man has thoughts that are rational. I don't know that he makes movies that follow up on those.
Yeah, but it's just sadly his reputation precedes him, though.
Right.
All right,
but
so let's
you know,
go.
at least he's like he's looking beyond his capabilities. You know, he's challenging himself in some way.
I think that's a good point. All right. So speaking of Oliver Stone, let's just get to it.
What's that? A beautiful segue. I mean, I gotta applaud myself on that.
I mean, hell, I'll send you a check in the mail.
Seamless. Hey, first of all, what time does Uwe come on your show tonight, Mike?
It's 10:00.
10:00 Eastern.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'll be listening to that. That's going to be a lot of fun. Okay, Oliver Stone. We all are Oliver Stone fans on this show, so I know there's some people in the chat room who are not. But we happen to dig him. But we were all
I think for different reasons, I think. I don't know if we all like him for the same reasons, but we...
Well, why do you like him?
Oh, I realize that. I'm just saying we all have different takes on him, I think.
Yeah. I mean, there are some.
I don't think he should be sent to Iceland. No,
there's some movies that he made that I like that you don't like, and vice versa. I'm sure.
Right. Exactly.
But he's where he belongs. I think.
Sorry.
He's mounting a project. It's already mounted. It's shooting now. About the life of George W. Bush, our current president. Stars Josh Brolin, Elizabeth Banks. Is that Laura Bush?
Yes.
Help me out here. Who else is in it, buddy?
Oh, okay. They keep
Scott
casting.
Glenn.
No, Rumsfeld has been cast. Scott Glenn, I believe, is Rumsfeld.
Yeah.
Sandy Newton is Condoleezza Rice.
Johan Griffold is Tony Blair.
He's Tony Blair? Wow, okay.
Mr. Fantastic from the Fantastic Four.
Mr. Fantastic is Tony Blair. Oh, this thing is heating up.
And then there's speculation that Giamatti would be, what, Dick Cheney?
Yeah, they
haven't
cast
Rove.
That's the big part that has not been cast yet, officially.
Oh, my.
They offered it to Robert Duvall. Robert Duvall turned it down.
Oh,
Colin
really?
Powell, who's playing Colin Powell?
I'm sorry?
I think isn't Jeffrey Wright?
Isn't
Jeffrey Wright?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm up on the cast list right now. Whoa, okay, before I say anything... Before we talk, Rob Corddry is Ari Fleischer.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
How great is that?
Excuse me, guys. I have to leave the room because I was just gonna burst out laughing. In a good way.
He has a hairdo. That's it. That's the only resemblance whatsoever. They have the exact same bald.
Okay.
Pattern.
Let's start talking about what we think about this whole project. I mean.
Okay.
Jamie, let's start with you.
Oh, okay. Well, this is where I'm coming from with Oliver Stone. I think this is where I like him to be. I like him to stir shit up. I like him to make built movies with built-in controversy. I think this is where he thrives as a creative person. That being said, I don't get good vibes about W. I might be of the ilk that I think it might be too soon. To be objective, which isn't one of Oliver Stone's strong suits anyway. But at the at the same time, it all depends on the tone. I think the tone is wrong. When I see the photos from these characters in dress, when I even read like the supposed script leaks,
mm-hmm.
when I read the interview with Oliver Stone and how he's going to portray this man, I think his tone is off.
Mm-hmm.
I think he needs to make a satire and not a straight political movie like a Nixon. That's my take on it so far. How do you disagree with that or agree with that?
All right, I guess I'll go. I agree with you. I think it's too soon only because we don't have the whole that we know that in the next couple of months up till the election, a lot of stuff that Bush is going to do a lot of things. He is actively, I think, taking an active part in this campaign, whether McCain likes it or not. And there's just a lot of this. The problem with making a movie or writing a book, especially a nonfiction book, and I've read a lot about this era and a lot about our current president, is things are happening every week, if not daily. The story keeps changing, keeps evolving. And this film I don't think is going to have a long shelf life. It's going to be dated very quickly, the way it's being rushed. Don't you guys think that?
What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, I think it would be dated. And, yeah, I think, like I said when we talked about it, when the project first came up, it's important. First of all, it has to be said, I love Oliver Stone. Oliver Stone hasn't made a good movie in over 10 years. I love the guy. I really love his films.
What was the last?
Probably Nixon, right? I mean, that's what
That's longer than 10 years. Okay, yeah.
Yeah,
well,
that's fair.
So
that's like 13 years. So
13 years. So that's what I said, over 10 years, give or take. And before that, you know, he was on quite a fucking hell of a run through the 80s and into the 90s. And then all of a sudden, something just isn't working anymore in his movies. Now, it's true he took a long time period off. But I think the tone is everything in this movie.
Yeah.
It's got to be. He's got to be able to do something that surprises us, because when you see on paper Oliver Stone making a movie about George Bush, everybody, myself included, just kind of rolls their eyes and go, oh, okay. You know, it's like, you know what it's going to be. It's like, there's no surprise.
Can he tell us anything
there.
New?
Yeah, what
That's
are you...
That's the part of the problem.
Yeah, it's like, oh, they're making a movie about the... They're finally making a big screen movie about the O.J. Simpson murder. Oh, really? Who's making it? O.J. Simpson. okay, well... Oh, I kind of know what that's going to be. That's what this is like.
Didn't he surprise people with his interpretation of Nixon? I mean that it felt even-handed, and that he saw Nixon as a tragic figure, someone that was brilliant but suffered from definite kind of personality defects that affected his presidency.
That helped the film tremendously.
I don't see that I don't see that you can see Bush as a tragic. That's a tragic kind of Shakespearean character. Like
no, God, no. He's an argument against legacies at colleges.
Even if you like George Bush, I don't think that's the character.
There's nothing tragic. It was like almost everything given to him on a plate.
Yeah.
I mean, very privileged upbringing.
Which is the stance that he's taking? How does this? How does this rambunctious Texas oil man, this fun-loving kind of, kind of the least accomplished of the siblings, kind of the least serious for the longest period of his life?
They thought Jeb would be the one.
How does he become the leader of the free world?
Yeah.
I think that's satire. I think that's just like I think John Media said in the chat room. That's the primary colors tone.
Yeah.
That's how I view the film, but I don't think that he views it the same way.
No. Let me throw this out here. I think when Stone deals with the 60s or 60s-related issues, it's when he makes his strongest films, his best films, his masterpieces. When it comes to more current times, and especially the present, I don't know how this film is going to work, and we really don't. But I think his strength, his masterpieces really are the 60s, his youth.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Primary Colors is a perfect example. Look at what happened with Primary Colors. The book was a monster success, but not people really didn't want to go see the movie. It wasn't,
And the Lewinsky thing broke.
Well, yeah, and it was, but there had been several scandals before then.
Yeah.
And, the Lewinsky thing happened right around then. But people just didn't care. I mean,
yeah, you're right.
The best movie in the world anyway. People just kind of stayed away from it. They, mm-hmm. You know, there's no point in seeing it. They can see it every day on the
movie. That's right.
You know?
Like with, I guess you could say, the war films in the last year. They just see it every...
Right.
Yeah.
Why?
I don't agree. Someone in the chat room says that satires of Bush have been overdone. I think that there's a difference. If this were an all-out comedy... Yeah, I mean, we hear the punchlines about Bush every night on late night and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Satire is something different. I mean, people have been making fun of Clinton years prior to Primary Colors. The Primary Colors resonated because there was some depth behind it. Satire makes you laugh, but it also, the very nature of it, it makes you think about the replications of what you're laughing at, you know?
I think we're disagreeing, though, because I don't think Primary Colors did resonate
The book resonated, but you have to remember the book resonated because no one knew who the author was for the longest time. That was really the big deal about the book. Who wrote this?
Right.
That
right.
was really this. Everyone was just wanted to know who wrote this book. So for months it was on the bestseller list. I worked in a bookstore at the time, and that's all anyone wanted to know. Who wrote this?
I think Primary Colors resonated because it showed... It was comedic, but at the same time, it explored this character, you know, loosely based on Clinton, with all of his faults, all of his womanizing. It did not shy away from any of that. Even like getting a teenager pregnant and having to keep it secret,
right?
And asking the question, you know, but he has so many other qualities that is it a compromise? Are you willing to take this compromise? Should this be the deciding factor of who your president is? I mean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's the Clinton legacy for a lot of people, is that question.
Except with Bush, there's no compromise. There's no upside.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. For a good number of people, yeah.
I just think in one sense, you're right, Jamie, it's too soon. But in another sense, can he tell us anything we don't already know? And
exactly.
What
there's
I'm worried about...
There.
Well, I shouldn't say worried. I'm not worried. It's not like I'm losing sleep. This movie has the potential to be like Kitty Kelly's book on the Bushes that came out right before the last election, which was a really big seller before the election.
Right.
But it has, I'm afraid, that's what I'm right now comparing it to. It has that feel.
It's an interesting family. I mean, it's an interesting family dynasty.
Why not talk about Prescott Bush? That's
that would be a good story. The other good story would be how... the country has kind of rolled over and been kind of apathetic towards it to a large extent. Why the media and why the Senate rolled over, and now they're regretting it on Iraq.
There's a lot
of interesting stories in there outside of Bush becoming president, you know?
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And remember, he said that when World Trade Center came out, he said he wanted to make a movie... Someone asked him about conspiracy theories, he says a conspiracy, not so much conspiracy, but why has the country allowed itself to be hoodwinked by this administration?
Right.
And I would think that's the direction he'd want to go in. You're right. Why does the country, the media, everything, is he going to touch on that?
I would think that he would be remiss not to, but in the confines of telling the Bush story, I don't know that it would fit.
Right.
The way they've outlined it,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. There's so many question marks. We're just going on what has been released so far. And Chris, I know that you've been kind of feeling icky about a quote that Oliver Stone made in an Entertainment Weekly article, which is the definitive article so far covering this production, where Oliver Stone has said, you know, you say this at this time, you say this in another time, and you match them together as one phrase at one time. Who cares? You know, it's that playing with history kind of that you feel a little awkward about, don't you?
Yeah, that's what that article is what originally made me think that it was going to be a satire. That's
mm-hmm.
what put that idea in my mind. But yeah, he's sort of done that with other movies, and sometimes it's really noticeable, and sometimes it's not really noticeable.
Right.
And you know, he doesn't just do it with, you know, history. He just kind of has a very, you know, he's absolutely an auteur. So look at what he did with Tarantino's script. He sees his own vision, his singular vision, as kind of unbending, and he can do it better. Whether it's a script that someone wrote, he can make it better, or if it's actual history, he can make it better.
Right,
know?
Right.
So I hope that he's able to kind of hone that in, because it can work. You can do that to a certain extent, but that's been a major criticism that people have had of him for years and years and years, is that he strays away from the truth and takes things that are sort of accusations and maybe, you know, maybes and could-bes, and he turns them into fact. So hopefully he won't do that, because there's plenty of fact with this story that is upsetting and should make people angry. There's no need to go and take it and make up things that George Bush did. He did plenty.
Did stuff that you couldn't write. I mean, you're absolutely right, Chris.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of people are going to watch the movie, they're going to find out new things just because they don't absorb a lot of the media and they don't read. But, you know, so it doesn't bother me that you won't find out anything new necessarily. I mean, I don't know how much you're going to find new out about Lincoln if you're schooled on Lincoln from Spielberg's. It's all about telling a great story and being a dramatist, which
Stone,
was his strength with Nixon and JFK. I mean, he puts you in there. He is a dramatist.
With the Doors even, too.
Yeah, and I didn't quite like the Doors.
The Doors doesn't hold up as well as, like, when the first time I saw it, but to an extent. But I think with Nixon and JFK, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. I want to thank everyone in the chat room who's joined. Let me go down the list. For those of you that are still in here, let me thank guest 1065, whoever you might be. Rosie, Buzzworthy, Radio, thank you. Kitten Fist, I know who you are. Thanks, Kitten Fist. Joel, our good friend Joel, John Media. Wanda Wayne, Mike from HMF Radio, make sure you tune into their show tonight. 10 o'clock, you said?
10 o'clock. 10:05, to be precise, one of them said.
For Uva Bowl.
Uva Bowl.
And thank you, Alan Levy. He stopped by for about 2 seconds.
And it's John Medina. Not John Media, John Medina. He's a long time listener.
Oh, I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry.
Long time listener.
My dyslexia acting up. let me go to our page real quick. Let me tell you what you guys have in store for you on the weeks upcoming on Blog Talk Radio. You guys talk amongst yourselves while my computer loads. Go ahead.
All right. Besides Bush, I guess, or it's W. It's called W. Is that the actual working title?
W is what it's being called, yeah. W is the title of the film, according to Entertainment Weekly and IMDb.
Is this, it's supposed to come out in October.
Yeah, the studio wants it to come out before the election. Originally it was said that was Oliver Stone's desire, but in this Entertainment Weekly interview, he basically says, that seems like a little bit of a push, you know, that seems like it's going to be difficult. He says he's done it before, but he can do it. So that's up in the air. For me, I'd rather just take your time and make the movie.
Try to make a really good movie.
Yeah, it's not going to impact. This thing is not going to impact an election.
No, it's not. I don't think
so. There's no reason, you know? That's what do you know anyone, Jerry, who would be impacted by an Oliver Stone movie?
No. No, I don't. I really
However,
don't.
He's one of the few directors whose work has actually made an impact if you go by JFK. I mean,
that's true, but do you honestly think someone who goes to see, let's say someone goes to see W, and they'd be, oh, I'm not, and they wanted to vote, well, I don't know who they wanted to vote for, but if they wanted to vote for McCain, they'd be, oh, I can't vote for McCain now.
Right.
I don't see that happening. I have to agree with Chris.
No, I don't. I agree
actually,
with all,
Even with JFK, there are historians who would say the fact that, you know, young people grew up watching JFK is actually a negative, not a positive, because there are things in that movie that are accusation and not necessarily proven, you know. But people who only have that...
I'm just speaking in terms of them releasing the papers that they weren't going to release for another 40 years or something. As a result of that movie, he was actually testifying to the House about, you know, we need to do this. And even if the papers were released and they had black marks all the way through them, I mean, it made the government take action in some way. A movie did, you know.
Right.
Coming up, Blake Snyder, our screenwriting guru, one of our favorite guests. He was great the last segment we had with us months
ago. Yes, he was.
He's going to return to us Wednesday night. He requested to come on. He wants to talk about summer movies. That's going to be a lot of fun. And then on the 25th, which I think is next Sunday, we're going to have a look back at the Rambo series with special guests including Matt Zoller-Seitz from the House Next Door website. He has very specific ideas about that, the legacy of Rambo and what it represents. So that's going to be awesome to hear. Also, roundtable reviews in the new indie film, and author Pamela J. Smith, the author of The Power of the Dark Side, will be joining us. That's all next Sunday, Wednesday the 28th. Right now, so far in the second segment, we have the director of a movie called Raising Jeffrey Dahmer, which is really interesting because, you know, I've always been curious about. We're talking about notorious serial killers. I've always been curious about what it's like to be related to that person. And this one actually explores the father, who was such a central figure during that time, sitting next to his son in the jail cell being interviewed, defending and yet not being able to defend his son because it's indefensible crimes. It's a very unique kind of place to be, I would think.
indefensible crimes. His son was Yuba Bull?
And then the week after, we'll be exploring, delivering a Dirty Harry retrospective with acclaimed critic David Edelstein. And on the 4th, our Sidney Lumet tribute, and this should be an all-star event. Sidney Lumet, one of the great actors, directors of all time. And then we'll be following that up the following Wednesday on the 11th of June with a nostalgic look back at the summer of 1983. We're talking about some really, like, great quirky films that we grew up on, and it should be a great look back.
Right.
And in the meantime, we have several pending interview requests out there. You never know who's going to pop up. We could have some great, great guests upcoming that I haven't mentioned to you tonight. So be on the lookout for our blogs and bulletins. Thanks, everyone out there, for joining us in the chat room and outside of the chat room. And we thank you so much, and we'll talk to you Wednesday
All right.
night.
Good night, everyone.
Are you a filmmaker looking for a great score for your next movie? Well, look no further than Michael McCormick, the composer whose works you hear at the opening and the closing of every episode of Movie Geeks United. This is a phenomenal talent, and you can hear more samples of his work at michaelmccormickmusic.com or on his MySpace page, which you can access through the Movie Geeks United Top Friends.